This is Mags Hall. You're listening to The Clear Spot on Resonance 104.4 FM. This is the first of two programmes made up of interviews I conducted at this year's School of Sound Symposium. The School of Sound was founded in 1998 by Diane Friedman and Larry Sider. It's a fascinating four-day international gathering dedicated to sound designers working in film, TV and radio, and those studying and with an interest in the subject, with talks from some of the world's leading practitioners, artists and educators. Tonight you will hear interviews with former BBC broadcaster Piers Plowright and cinema sound system inventor Tomlinson Holman, who gave 5.1 surround sound its name.
I say, you there. Yes, I mean you. You listening. Well, don't. I mean it. Don't listen. I'll tell you what I want you to do. I know this must sound very sudden to you, and I ask you to excuse me, but I don't want you to get interested in any way. Don't get hooked, as they say. I want you to get up and come and switch this off. Don't let me or anyone else bamboozle you into giving up an hour of your life to listening to radio. It's not worth it.
My name is Piers Plowright, and I worked for the BBC as a feature and drama producer, radio, never telly, for 30 plus years. Retiring and still going on lecturing and shooting my mouth off, really, about this marvellous medium, which I'm still passionate about. The School of Sound, which began 8 years ago, it was really accidental, I think. Larry Sider, who is the founder of it with his wife, Diane Freeman, heard of me through something and said, would I give a talk about radio? And they might as well start with that, because they were going to move on to sound in film. And so I began. And now I'm a fixture, really. I mean, I suppose one day they'll sack me, but they haven't had the nerve so far. And I'm always interested in the way that film and radio do interact and have things in common. Can't exactly explain that. I think it's partly to do with the effect of montage, which you can do in sound and in vision, how you create pictures with two things to make a third thing, which is equally true in radio. It may also be to do with storytelling. Somehow the two things seem to mirror each other. And then I've always felt that radio has a visual power which almost nothing else equals, apart from the book. Funnily enough, the book, the written word, the thing that you hold in your hand and decide when you start, when you finish, how long you take over it, whether you turn a page or not, still seems to me actually the most powerful of all our audio-visual experiences. The words have a resonance, so do the look of the print. And the stories that are there, which are in a way like your own stories, because it's just you and the author sharing these secrets. That for me is the strongest. And then comes radio, which is the one I know. Again, because there are things for you, the listener, you, the program maker, to leave out. The imagination fills in. And after that, probably theatre, which I've always loved, and or film. I mean, I am a film fan. I love it. But I probably look at films rather as I made radio programmes. I look at what isn't there, which I think is the power of a great filmmaker. You know, a great filmmaker doesn't put everything in, orally or visually. And yet you get the impression that everything is there. We've just had a lecture this morning about how Alfred Hitchcock in The Birds creates a complete illusion through the use of sound that a classroom of children are singing when they're not actually opening their mouths, and that a group of crows are fluttering their wings when they're not actually making sound, because most of them are stuffed. And it's all done with the linear line of a rather boring children's song that goes on and on and on and on, increasing the tension. So sound in movies does what radio does for vision. Something missing, indicated, but not described. I mean, I think that art is about the heart. There's no doubt about it. I think being moved is terribly important. And very often when we talk about radio these days, we talk in terms of techniques, fast-moving skills, editing skills, the ability to jump time, if you like. In other words, to play with our experience, which I think is fine. But if it doesn't resonate in the heart, if it doesn't actually say something to us about humanity, my feeling is it doesn't entirely work, which isn't to say that I don't like games. And I played a piece in my lecture called All Boys Used to Whistle, which is actually a game for two elderly people remembering the past. And it's highly playful, highly inventive on the part of the maker of the program. But it's still about human emotions. And I think that for me is the absolute key. When we go to conferences about anything, really, including the arts, people don't mention the word love very often because, I don't know why, I suppose they feel that it's too vague or possibly unfashionable. But I think it's always there, the tingle factor, which is to do with being stirred emotionally. And I can't get away from it.
Could you tell me, do you have a favourite sound designer?
My favourite sound in movies is actually a rather odd one. It's Jacques Tati in almost all his films, because Jacques Tati, I think long before sound was quite so complex or could be made in such a complex way, saw that sound was crucial to his comedy and really to the whole look and feel of a film. So if I think back to Les Vacances de Monsieur Hulot, which must be from the late 50s, early 60s, I'm not quite sure, or even earlier, I remember a sequence where the guests at this small seaside hotel in France are going through the door into the dining room, and there's a door that goes bzzung, bzzung, each time they go through, and it becomes hilarious because you're waiting for it. It's also his acute ear has picked up the fact that in this sort of place where nobody oils the doors ever, you get these eccentric sounds. And Tati, I think, was a master of sound, usually for comedy, sometimes for kind of haunting memory effects. So I admire him very much. Tarkovsky's use in Solaris, which is a film I've only just seen, is quite extraordinary. And there is the motorway ride where it turns into a sort of space journey through use of music and acoustic change, really.
Thank you.
I very much admire the films of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, who are enjoying, I'm glad to say, a kind of resurgence of popularity. And again, if you look at their films, the sound is very unconventional, not at all naturalistic, particularly thinking of a moment in A Matter of Life and Death, where David Niven is taken by ambulance to have an operation. It's a long story as to why he's going by ambulance, but you don't notice that the ambulance sound has completely stopped. In fact, they're probably not. The film is probably shot, it's stationary on a set with a flashing blue light outside, otherwise nothing. The moment the doors open, suddenly the bustle of the hospital, the engine noise of the ambulance and so on. So this kind of dropping out of reality and dropping back in again was something that, as a radio maker, I was fascinated by, since I've never believed that documentary making, for example, which has been my main achievement, is that the word, in radio, I've never believed it was really about naturalism. It's about selection and juxtaposition.
It's 7 o'clock. I'd like to make the first toast. Oh. I think it's my responsibility as the eldest son. Isn't that right, Helmut?
Of course, Christian, please.
But first, I've got a speech I'd like to make about my father. Now, I've written two speeches, actually, so you get to choose which one I give. One is green, the other one is yellow.
Take the yellow one!
That's better, you miserable old sod.
Yeah, look, he's snapped right out of it now.
There's nothing like a good trick to liven me up. I like a wheeze. Well done, Christian.
I'll have the green one.
Mm-hmm. The green one. The green one is a very interesting choice.
Is it?
It's a kind of truth speech, and I've decided to call it When Daddy Takes a Bath. I was very small when we moved here, and I loved it. And I dare say it was the beginning of a new era for all of us. We all had this space for the first time, all the room we could wish for. And Linda, my sister, who is now dead, we used to get up to a lot of trouble tearing around this place, see? Then, as you know, this was a restaurant. It's where we are now, and I can't think of how many times Linda would put something in the food without the guest discovering it. A petal or something like that. And we would sit there and watch them, and Linda would scream with delight. She had the most infectious laugh you could imagine. I can hear her now. We never lasted hiding for more than 2 seconds before we were caught, rolling around the floor, screaming with laughter. We always got found out. But nothing ever happened. Actually, as it turned out, it was much more dangerous when Dad was going to have a bath. Now, I'm not sure if all of you remember, but Dad, he was always taking baths. And every time he had a bath, he took Linda and me into his office. And there were some things he liked to do first, like lock the door, pull the blinds down, turn the lights off, and switch one of the lamps on. Everything had to be just so for him. Then he took off his shirt and trousers, and we had to do the same. And he lay us down on the green sofa, and he raped us. He raped us. He took advantage of us sexually. He had sex with his precious children. I think you threw out the green sofa, didn't you, Dad? A couple of months ago, when Linda died, I realized that my father was a very clean man, and I thought this was something I want to share with the rest of the family. I thought you should know this about my father. I want you to know that about Helga. Helga is a clean man, a very clean man, my father. Anyway, we're here to celebrate, and I think we should do that. You know, just think what it's like to live a long life, to see your children grow up, your grandchildren grow up. Okay, enough of all that. We're not here to hear me talk all evening, we're here to celebrate, and I think we should do that. So thank you for all the good years. Congratulations. Happy birthday.
We hadn't got anything to drink.
You played a piece from what is going to be a radio play on Festen, which obviously was the Lars von Trier film.
Festen is about to be a radio production on Radio 3, I think mainly because the language is fairly powerful, Radio 3 can get away with it, in April, so any moment. And it is the text, more or less, as presented on the stage, and it is the same actors who are appearing on stage in London now. So it must have been an interesting experience. I wasn't there for the recording. They didn't presumably have scripts, and most radio plays, the actor is always slightly, you know, problematically carrying a script. So there was a freedom about it. But they also wanted to make it a radio experience, and I think it succeeded. Without giving away the denouement, Feston is about a young man dropping a bombshell at his father's 60th birthday party during his speech. And it was very powerful on film in Lars von Trier's Dogma production. It is extremely powerful in the theatre in London at the moment. And the same English cast went to a studio in Maida Vale late last year and recorded it for radio. When I say it was more or less the same. Some of the sound effects were different. The cast was the same, which of course was wonderful because they didn't have to clutch scripts in their hands, which is always one of the problems with radio drama, how you make the script invisible, whereas actors who've inhabited a part through rehearsal and so on can do that. So it has that power. It works extremely well in radio, I think, partly because the silences are so powerful. And in a play in which a family is torn apart at a public occasion, silence is going to be quite prominent. So that works very, very well indeed. It's pretty shattering in the theatre. But I think if listeners tune in to this Radio 3 production sometime in April, they will be chilled to the bone.
Quite interestingly, another piece of radio that you also chose to play us at the School of Sound was made in the 1970s of Crime and Punishment. I'm quite interested to hear your opinions about this piece, because for me it took away the intimacy of that moment. Whereas the other piece by Feston, which we've just heard, was very emotional but very, very unnerving. This could be an example of the way in which radio drama has changed and improved dramatically.
Very good point. I mean, for me, because I first heard that production in 1975 when it was new, remains absolutely classic and thrilling. But I can see that it was a style that was very popular at the time, stereo being quite young, the possibility of voices within voices being very enticing, the fact that that story is very multi-layered anyway. The temptation is to go to town, which indeed the producer did. For me it works, but I'm very interested to hear it didn't work for you, and perhaps that's something the audience might... I should have asked them if there'd been time for questions. Yes, it is. It's about change in style. Although one has to say that the murder of an old lady on the stairs with an axe is a pretty physical thing. And if you are going to take it out of the pages of the book, apart from just telling it like a, you know, book of bedtime, I think you have to do something about it. And I actually admire the way in which, by having three murderers, well, shall we say, the voice of his conscience, the voice of the devil, and the voice of the terrified young man who's actually doing the murder, I think that creates a tension, a counterpoint, which makes the murder just as terrible, but stops us giggling, because that is the danger. You know, when people get hit on the head on radio, ooh, ah, ooh, yeah, it does sound very hysterically funny, but that, for me, it avoided that. So I'm interested that you were probably on the edge of giggles, were you?
No, I wouldn't say giggles, but I could hear particular sounds which were very much a sort of motif of special effects. And, you know, you
meant
using a cabbage, for instance, okay, if they were sort of handmade in the studio. But I think it's just to do with the difference in the ability to make much more subtle radio now, which is something that seems to be one of the themes already at this year's festival, which is talking about the use in which surround sound has enabled a new kind of subtlety in film soundtrack.
I think you make a very interesting point. And of course, radio drama, when I started in it, was a bit like the Japanese Bunraku puppet theatre, in as much as if you watched it, it was like watching a ritual, because you had your spot effects operator who had the cabbage, the knife, the cup of tea, the blood, all that stuff, moving ghost-like around the actor, who simply had a script and was being an actor. Then you had the Grams player playing in sounds of footsteps or whatever else you needed, or street noises, in at the same time. All done sort of in one take, really. You didn't sort of add bits later. Although they probably added Raskolnikov's inner voice, because you couldn't very well do that at the same time. So it was technically more limited, which I think sometimes, and I think that was suggested by another speaker this morning in film terms, that having more technical resources doesn't necessarily mean superior storytelling. So I would defend the kind of slightly crude, but it's almost like a craft, isn't it? The craft of radio drama in the 70s. With its, I always remember when you're walking through Leaves in the Forest, you scrunched up some tape, put it on the ground, and the actors walked about in it or just stepped up and down in it. And that was perfectly okay. That was a convention for the forest. We probably wouldn't do that now. It would sound a bit cod. But it was the time. And I think it's a matter of opinion, training, style, whatever, whether it works or not. But you're right, we've moved on. There are, in a funny sort of way, the complexity of the possibilities in radio drama now make it possible to be simpler. And that's a good thing.
It's suddenly moved into sound design, hasn't it, really?
The sound design is a very interesting two words, are a very interesting two words, is a very interesting, a very interesting expression, because it hadn't been heard of, I don't think, in radio until quite recently. And it seemed to come from the theatre, where if you looked at the programme, you always had your composer, your director, your choreographer, and then another mysterious figure called sound designer. And that seems to come now into the radio scene, because you do find people who are not the director, who are not the studio managers, but they are someone else. They might be the composer, but not necessarily, creating an ambiance for the whole piece. And into that you can put numerous subtleties.
House by the canal. Now, just as before, round the house, into the right-hand doorway, up the back stairs. I'm not seen. This is the plan.
What is it? Painters, two painters, all's lost. Run, go back.
They won't see me. They're on a floor below her. They'll hear nothing. Be calm, quietly, calm. No one in the world knows I'm here. The fourth floor. Now, I have the axe. I have the pledge. I know what I must say.
Must I do it? She isn't there. She's gone. I needn't do it.
Ring again.
Oh, it would be so. I have no hope.
Hey, what do you want?
The sun does not shine. The sun does not shine.
Alyona Ivanovna, good evening. I've come, as I said, I've got something to pawn. Come over into the light. See what I have.
Who are you?
Rodion Raskolnikov. You know me. I came the other day. I said I'd be back with this. Look, take it. Look at it. I'm in a hurry.
Take it. Take it. Come on. Look down. Look down. Then I can open my coat. The axe is ready.
Ah, yes. I remember you. Don't rush me. What have you got?
A silver cigarette box, I told you.
Why is she so stupid? Start to unwrap it. Do it as it's supposed to happen.
You're trembling.
No.
Are you feeling all right? You haven't been taking baths, have you?
I've had a fever.
Why do you wrap it up like this?
Don't talk. Look down. Look down. Now.
No, no, no.
Why is it all tied up?
My hands are weak. They'll slip on the axe.
Do it. Do it. Now.
Oh, she's so small, the axe will come down the top of her head.
With the blunt end, raise it. Now. And strike. And again.
She cries out a very little cry, the blood rushes out.
Again, the same spot.
She falls, the blood gushes, so much blood.
I'm so calm, so perfect. There must be no blood on me. Put the axe by the body. So. She's dead.
A piece that you also played from the sort of 70s, which I thought worked really well, was The Diary of a Madman.
The Diary of a Madman was the Gogol novel, And it was going to be an animated film in 1963, animated by a brilliant animator called Richard Williams, but he ran out of funds. But he had recorded Kenneth Williams, no relation, the great comedian, Round the Horn, etc. He had recorded him being the madman. The sound was recorded, and it's an extraordinary virtuosic performance. So what has happened here is that a drama director called Ned Chaillet, in 1991, took, with permission, these recordings, treated them with the help of a wonderful technician called John Whitehall, so that the acoustic space was changed, the stereo width was used, and so on, and some rather wonderful music, which is slightly reminiscent of Miles Davis, put in. And it doesn't attempt to be realistic, and of course the fact that it's narrated by a man who's going or is mad, it has an extraordinary power. Very formal, very contrived, very what I call cooked radio. In other words, it's been processed, terrifically processed, but I think it works triumphantly. And it's a classic example of what you can do with sound and skillful voicing, I think.
And certainly, knowing more about Kenneth Williams from his diaries, he'd be very proud to have been part of the programme, because it was something he wanted to do, was more serious acting. And obviously he felt very, very frustrated, didn't he, about being stuck in a sort of BBC box of having to be funny all the time.
Yeah, I mean, Kenneth Williams is the archetypal tragic comedian, isn't he? He's very widely read, highly intelligent, capable of great dramatic range, and quite wonderful in Round the Horn and anything else he appears in. I mean, absolutely show-stopping. But longing to be Hamlet, and for a moment in this piece he is, so it's wonderful that we have it.
Madrid, April 30th. This morning, the Spanish deputation finally arrived for me. The rapidity of our journey struck me as strange. In half an hour, we reached the Spanish frontier. And so, I am in Spain. A strange land, Spain. When we entered the first room, I saw a great many people with shaven heads. I guessed they must be grandees. The manner of the King's Chancellor seemed very strange to me. He pushed me into a small room and said, "Sit here, and if you go calling yourself King Ferdinand, I'll beat it out of you." Then he struck me with a stick. I knew it was only a test. They still observe the manners of chivalry in Spain. On being left alone, I decided to occupy myself with the affairs of the realm. But I was vexed at an event which is to happen tomorrow. Tomorrow, at 7 o'clock, a strange phenomenon will take place. The earth will mount the moon. I was troubled at heart when I imagined the heaviness of the earth and the moon's unusual softness and lack of durability. I hurried into the council chamber with the intention of giving the police orders not to allow the earth to mount the moon. The shaven grandees in the council chamber were a very wise people, and when I said, "Gentlemen, let us save the moon because the earth wants to mount it," they all rushed to fulfill my royal wish, and many of them climbed the walls in order to get to the moon. But at this moment, the High Chancellor entered. Seeing him, they all scattered.
As king, I remained alone.
Lance Corporal Baranowski's Vietnam is a mixture of archive, the privately recorded tapes of Lance Corporal Michael Baranowski, who was killed at the age of 24, 25 in that war. He recorded these tapes on a little battered tape recorder he'd bought somewhere in Vietnam to send back to his parents, and they treasured them. And they returned him, actually, taped letters for him to listen to back in his foxhole in Vietnam. He also did very playful things with spoof radio plays and stuff, which is very amusing, which I didn't play any of that this morning. The other extraordinary thing is that you're listening in at one level to a young man on the edge of death and real war. It isn't a question of Hollywood film sounds suggesting war. It is actually the killing that's going on in Vietnam coming through his little microphone. So you're hearing that, and then you're hearing his great mate from the war who survived in 2004 looking back at what it was like. So you've got two layers of reality, one archive, one modern, both remembering a war which everybody knows about and is the kind of classic example of a misguided political action. And it's terribly moving because it doesn't take any stance. It isn't a pro-war, against war, anything. It's simply one young man living and dying and what it means to his family now to have these tapes and actually making this programme. I didn't make it, Alan Hall made it. But making this programme for them was a chance to purge the grief and the emotion they'd kept bottled up all these years. So it's very powerful. And it won the gold, Sony Gold Award last year for documentaries.
Yeah, that's of interest. Well, I think it is quite chilling in that you do get the feeling that it is anti-war because you know this person is just about to die and the immediacy of the situation and that, for most people, I think, would put them off war.
Yeah, that's something. I think we read that anti-war stance into it, but funnily enough, the family are quite kind of old-fashioned patriotic Americans who probably would be ambiguous about the Vietnam War, probably entirely pro the Iraq invasion, for example. So, you know, it isn't a kind of attack on American values. It's simply about one young man. But I quite agree, you listen to it now and you can't help seeing it in the shadow of history.
Everything's been quiet for about 15 minutes now. I was just crouching down in the hole there, talking to a hand grenade. I thought it was the microphone. I realized what I was doing. Sounds of the Enchanted Forest.
You're always scared. As much as you don't want to think about it, it's kind of a natural thing. You learn to accept it. You can't get rid of it. You learn to live with it. And even in today's life, it's still a frightening thing and it's still there.
Well, there you go.
This was not Hollywood. At the other end of all that you are listening to, people are really dying. You know, I don't want to think about that. But that is the reality. It wasn't a Hollywood soundtrack. There were real Marines shooting real bullets at real people.
Let's just hope we don't get picked for a reactionary squad. Jesus. That's too close.
You talked of radio being like a cinema of the blind. Obviously, this is something that many radio theorists talk about endlessly and argue about endlessly. I don't know if you've read any Paddy Scammell, he's argued quite recently that, of course, this idea of calling radio a blind medium is actually a very unactive way of describing what is a quite active medium. Could you see that perhaps referring to radio as a blind medium is perhaps a negative?
Yes. I mean, the context really that I said Cinema of the Blind was a particular story about Kafka and his friend Gustav Janouch wandering around Prague and coming across this incredibly named cinema and finding it very funny. I think probably slipped out of me, that you could look at radio as a cinema of the blind, but only in the sense that blind people, of course, have a huge visual perception, or if that's not the right phrase, they have an imaginative grasp of what the world might be. I'm not suggesting that it's a kind of second-hand cinema, because I quite agree, I think that's a great mistake. I also, by the way, very much object to radio, and there's rather a lot of it now that says, we are now standing at the west door of Westminster Cathedral, and as you can see, there are 14 saints carved in stone, 6'3" high, and with each holding bunches of lilies. You know, it seems to me a waste of time to do all that. We're not trying to be a substitute. We're not kind of a film that hasn't unfortunately got any pictures. We are a film in the sense that we go as deep as film does, and we suggest. So to that extent, I don't regard it as a cinema of the blind. It was a handy phrase for that particular moment. Of course, it's a much more positive, it's a much more positive experience than just sitting in the dark wishing we could see.
But this does tie into one of the pieces you played, which was about a young blind girl being asked to describe what an elephant looks like.
Mm-hmm. Well, Touching the Elephant, it's called, a Matt Thompson production from about 7, 8, 9 years ago, is about four blind people imagining an elephant, and it comes directly from a Sufi tale, which is about perception. If you can't see, what is an elephant? Depends which bit you touch. And so it is very specifically about blind people imagining. But it works, I think, wonderfully, not because the people are blind, though that moves us, but because they allow their imaginations to roam far wider. If you ask an ordinary school child, what's an elephant like? I don't think they'd be as interesting as little Laura, who thinks it's furry until she meets one, might or might not have a mouth, but she notes something wonderful that I don't think an ordinary sighted child would think of straight away, the sound of its legs, its hooves, whatever elephants have, as it moves towards you, thundering over the earth, makes the earth shake. And that's a sort of perception which is deeper than children who just see elephants all the time, at least in newsreels and in pictures on walls.
What are they like? Can you describe an elephant to me?
Of course. Very big. They've got big ears.
Mm-hmm.
They're extra big. They've got long trunks.
And
they squirt water.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like the grey sky outside.
Their skin, what do you think their skin feels like?
Their skin's furry.
And what about tusks? Do you know what tusks are?
Yes, they're great big long teeth.
Does an elephant have a mouth?
No. Yes, he has, I think. And their stride is really noisy. You could feel the ground shake when they're coming. I'd like to feel an elephant.
Why?
I'd like to know what an elephant looks like, because I'm going to write a story about elephants, a little novel of my own.
What sort of personality do you think these elephants will have?
If they think people aren't going to hurt them, they're okay, but if people hurt them, they're really quite fierce. I'm a very imaginative girl, my mum says.
About 25 years ago, I recorded an old woman, she was 80 then, called Alison Whaley, remembering the death of her husband Arthur, who had been dead some 25 years when I recorded her. To be absolutely honest, I didn't realise how powerful a piece of radio or storytelling this was, because it was a winter day, she had a fire, a real fire in the room, and I was terribly tired and I kind of dozed off. Only when I got home and played the tape back did I realise I had a sort of extraordinary piece of oral poetry, which was her description in about 3 minutes of the death of her husband Arthur, translator of poetry from the Japanese and the Chinese. remembered 25 years back. And it has extraordinary silences in it, and I learned as a young producer not to edit those silences, which I first wanted to do, because they were part of her build-up, part of her own expression. And it does move people to tears or to absolute pin-drop silence, even if they might think with one part of themselves, well, this is a bit too perfect. How could she talk like this? The answer, of course, is that she's a storyteller. This is something she's talked about a lot. But it does remain my party piece, and you know that thing about what would you take with you if the house was on fire. I'd probably grab that the tape of that programme and rush out with it, because without my knowing it, it's the most powerful piece of radio I've ever caught. I won't say I made, but ever caught.
We always waked at 5 or 6 in the morning, and it was June, you see, and it was a blazing hot June when he died. And I wheeled his bed to the open window upstairs, and the sun streamed in on us, and we threw back the coverlets and stripped off everything that got brown in the sun, as we always did every morning, because the nurse came in at 8 o'clock. And then the day would become rather hideous, you know. Medical questions, which were not interesting to either of us. Arthur was not in pain. His spine was broken just between the shoulder blades, so from the breast down, he was paralyzed. He felt no pain. I asked him, "Are you in pain?" And he said, "I have never been so comfortable in my life." And I said, "And you look so happy. Why should I not be happy? I have music and you to read to me. Why should I not be happy?" And on this morning, we looked out at the sky, which was cloudless and brilliant. And Arthur had inserted into his new book of poems a poem which he, Arthur, said was for me alone. It was by Feng Meng Lu. And it was called "Don't Set Sail." It's very short. It begins, "Don't set sail. Tomorrow the wind may have dropped. And then you can go, and I shan't trouble about you." And on the morning of Arthur's death, there'd been a tremendous gale, a storm in the garden all through the night. And I had flung up the window, and there was the clear sky and not a breath of wind. And I turned and called back to him, "Darling, the wind has dropped." And he said, "Then I may go, and you shall not trouble about me." I thought my heart would stop. But it was true. It was just like that.
One of the final pieces that you played was about a young girl meeting her father for the first time. Again, very emotive, very much like fly on the wall documentary, but for radio, which is much more of a visual medium in a way, that kind of reportage.
The story of this girl meeting her absentee Nigerian father after many years, or at least 10, is intimate. It is extraordinarily intimate, because it's something we are slightly embarrassed about, I think, this sort of confrontation.
I've travelled a long way to get here today.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I don't even know where to start with my questions, other than I understand you've got, like, a life here, and I don't know how many brothers and sisters I have.
Well, altogether, you are 13.
13?
13.
The picture of the lady on the wall, your wife?
Mm-hmm.
Are they all her children?
No. The mum is in Lagos. The mum is not very fine now. She's sick. The only person I probably wanted to have as my wife was your mommy. But somehow, she said she would want to stay in England.
That was because of me.
I know, but I can't stay in England. That's the problem. In fact, she doesn't want me to discuss that with you.
Why couldn't you?
Pardon?
Why couldn't you stay in England?
Why can't he?
Why couldn't you stay in England?
Why?
Yes,
yeah,
why?
I can't stay in England. This is my country. I'm a prince of Nigeria. I'm a prince of Lagos. My parents, my father was the ruler
but
of this.
I had to be.
I understand you. I understand you. You have to be there.
Yeah.
She has to look after you.
But so do you.
I have to look after you, but you know, you are our only child.
But you didn't look after me.
You have not got the point. You are our only child.
Yeah.
You are not my only child.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
I cannot carry every other person to England. It would be too expensive for me to do that.
So instead of...
I had to educate them. I had to educate you.
But you didn't.
You think so? You ask your mom questions.
What did you... No, I'm asking you. I don't want to... I'll ask my mom later on.
Uh-huh.
But what did you do for me while I was in England?
I visited you.
When?
Oh, when you were a child.
And then
until you were six.
Not until I was six.
Until you were six.
No.
No, that's the truth.
It's not the truth.
I said that is the truth.
I was not six when he left me. He says I was six the last time he saw me. I was three the last time he saw me. After the first encounter, he did say that I was right. I'm always right.
I came all the way from London to see you.
Now. Yes. Uh-huh. That's right.
But not once have you come to see me. Now, I don't understand that. Maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm stupid.
No, you're not naive.
But as a child, I would expect my dad to be around.
To be around, yes.
So what happened?
The point is that I told you the number of children I have.
That doesn't mean anything to me. From my point of view,
yes.
I didn't ask you to have 13 children.
Yes.
You're my dad.
I had children before you.
So before because you. Of
no, take
your
it,
life.
Take it easy.
I don't think you understand.
No, take it easy because you don't be emotional. Don't be emotional. Take it easy. Don't be emotional. Take it little by little because I know what is going on. I had to teach here in Nigeria.
The way my mom's brought me up is that I value people and life more than money.
Yes.
And fair enough if you didn't have the funds, you're saying.
I did not have the funds.
You don't. From my point of view.
Yes.
I don't know that.
Yes.
All I know is that my dad is, I don't know how many thousands of miles away, not bothering to phone me, not bothering to write me, not sending me anything on my birthdays, not even calling me.
I was sending you
birthdays,
things before.
Christmas. But, Daddy, you can't say I was sending you things before. So what happened? What did I do to...
That was the broadcaster Piers Plowright talking to me, Mags Hall, at this year's School of Sound. The next interview we're about to hear is of surround sound inventor Tomlinson Holman talking about the future developments in surround sound.
Thank you. My name is Tomlinson Holman, and I teach film sound at the University of Southern California and consult on film sound issues. For instance, in my background, I started in film, and I left it because film sound quality was so bad in the middle 70s. I went off to home high-fidelity equipment design, where I designed amplifiers and loudspeakers and so forth, but then came back to film sound through the medium of Lucasfilm, where I developed the THX sound system, among other things. And I've been teaching for some 17 years, and researching and working on extensions to current sound systems. I worked on, I actually named 5.1 channel sound, which you may have heard of, and yet for the last 5 years or so, I've been working on 10.2 channel sound.
Well, I'm certainly intrigued to know more about 10.2. One of the things that you did brilliantly today was explain the history of surround sound, which I found totally of interest, and also the way that you were able to explain it with humour and not get too technical, which is probably helpful to the listeners, although many people listening to Resonance are musicians and artists, so they maybe have more of an idea than most. But when you're talking about traditional surround sound, 5.1, what would that be?
Well, it started with Walt Disney sitting down and thinking about Fantasia and how he could bring classical music to the masses. And what he was thinking of at the moment was Flight of the Bumblebee. While existing stereophonic sound had been invented by Bell Labs in 1934, by 1939 or 38, he was thinking about how he could add to that and have the bumblebee fly all around you during Flight of the Bumblebee. Ironically enough, Flight of the Bumblebee is on the cutting room floor and never wound up in Fantasia, and yet that was the genesis of surround sound. Surround sound has a way of coming and going, of dying before its time. Fantasia didn't work commercially, and the war intruded. The equipment was packed up to send to the Russians for use in propaganda, and the Fantasound equipment aboard a merchant marine ship sailed into the North Atlantic and was promptly sunk by a U-boat. So that ends the first act of surround sound. It came back in the 1950s with CinemaScope and Todd A.O. and Cinerama in order to have an experience that was bigger than you could get on television, which had started to compete very seriously for cinema viewers. It once again died out because it was very expensive to do, and it didn't come back until the middle 70s. The combination of technology with Dolby Stereo and compelling program material, Star Wars, made it a hit in 1977, and it's been growing ever since, first commercially in theaters and then through the medium of DVD in the home. 5.1 was already an existing format developed for Superman 1, here in England, as a matter of fact, to get the sound of Superman flying across the auditorium. The older systems had four channels, left, center, right, screen channels, and a single monaural surround channel, but that was split in two for Superman 1 to get these flying effects. It was used later the same year for Apocalypse Now to good artistic effect. So that was from 79. In 87, we had a meeting of how to get digital sound on film, and the number of channels was going around the room, 2, 4, 8, and I said, 5.1. And everyone said, what the heck is he talking about? What's 0.1 of a channel? And the truth of it is that technically speaking, it's really 5.005, where the 5 are left, center, right, left surround, and right surround, and the 0.005 of a channel is a single low-frequency channel meant to handle more signal level at low frequencies, because we hear bass less well than mid-range and treble, so we need more energy at low frequencies to sound equally as loud. But 5.1 was marketing rounding of 5.005. That caught on first in film in 92 and 3, and then in DVD in a big way in 97, and now it's ubiquitous. I wish I had a nickel for every time that term got invoked. Meanwhile, I've been working for a few years on extending it. You know, what does it do well and what does it do poorly? It images well in front and again in back. It does not image well at the sides. It produces a certain degree of an envelopment, but it can't fully envelop you. So by, you know, should some gods grant us more channels, my view is that we should use these in the way that is most effective with physical room acoustics, repeating what really happens physically, what stimulates the mind the best through psychoacoustics, and through the desires of musicians and composers. You know, if we look at the history of music, it starts long before this, but say it starts with Mozart, and we have relatively small forces, relatively small dynamic range, of course sublime music, there's no question about that. But nevertheless, as we move to, say, Beethoven, we get louder sounds and lower frequency sounds and wider frequency range. As we move to Mahler and Berlioz, they can't go any further. They've hit the limits of the audience in loudness and dynamic range and so forth. So they start breaking the proscenium and start putting choruses offstage and upstage and backstage and behind you and so forth. When we come to film sound, it tends to put things all around you. And so that's of interest. That is a fundamental of surround sound. When we look at what 5.1 does well and what it does poorly, we add to it additional channels that shall be granted someday. And we think that the next logical step is 10.2 channel sound, adding off-screen width channels, back surround that's already present in some surround formats. By this time, now we start with 5, we've added 2 width channels and a back surround channel. We're up to 8 in a circle. At this point, we say, well, let's break that plane because we can hear height, and we add height channels to that. And so we wind up with 10.2.
What's holding you back from moving towards using 10.2?
I'd say basically it takes a producer who is willing to take a risk. We have made 20 installations, 8 of them permanent, 12 of them temporary. And, you know, we kind of clunk along, adding some and adding some program material from year to year. Eventually, it will take a producer like that of Lawrence of Arabia to want to make a bigger experience than others have available to them to make that breakthrough. We don't know when that will come, but we think it's inevitable because there are only 3 things that determine the digital bit rate on a medium that determines everything. One is the frequency range, one is the dynamic range, and the third is the spatial capability. Well, the frequency and dynamic range are what engineers call saturating functions. You get enough of them, and you have enough of them, and going faster or having more bits really does not do you anything. Whereas everyone can hear the difference between mono and stereo, between stereo and 5.1 channel sound, and we think between 5.1 and 10.2 channel sound. It has not got an obvious upper limit. It's, we call it asymptotic to some upper limit. And you can get various estimates of that limit from 30 to a million, but nonetheless, it's a lot of channels. And we know that at 10, we are not pushing the limits of the envelope.
Now that we have DVD, is it possible to use 10.2 with DVD at this time?
Well, the current DVD system, as it is promulgated, only handles 5.1 in one stream, playable simultaneously. You can switch amongst multiple 5.1 streams. So clearly there's enough space on the medium. It's just a matter of conception. HD DVD coming about at the end of this year, we think will have extensions to more channels, especially through DTS and so forth. And if there is upwards pressure, I'm sure others will meet it. You know, this is not an everyday experience yet, but motion picture theaters have to compete with the home theater experience. And since that's getting so good, they need something on which to compete. And we think ultimately they will move upwards in the number of channels. After all, the audience has been pushed to its limits in terms of how loud it goes, and it covers the full audible frequency range. So the only logical direction to go is in more spatial capability, and that has to happen sooner or later.
It's all very exciting, isn't it? Are you quite confident that this is the way forward?
Well, it is the way. There's no question that it is the way forward. The question is, when is it economically feasible? You know, we've always had from 8mm to 16 to 35 to 65 negative, and yet most films are shot on 35 negative today. Could have been shooting them in 65, yet we're not, because producers wouldn't commit to the more expensive format, not knowing in advance how much box office they might get out of that format. As the costs fall, especially with digitized audio, you know, it's getting so cheap to store multi-channels. You know, the difference is when the CD came out in the early 80s, that was the most technically accomplished thing that had ever been released on the public into the home. And its conception, though, was to just follow the two-channel model. Today, where we're much more used to computers, a flexible model is much more likely. For instance, we have two recordings. One of them is of Messiah, Hallelujah Chorus, in a very fine concert hall where you are completely in the audience and complete with reverberation and applause and so forth, wonderfully represented. And then with a push of a button, we can take the same audio stream and change it with metadata and put you inside the chorus to give you the sing-along Messiah perspective that's very popular in America. And you can go and stand next to your section, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, around the left surround, back surround, and center and right surround, and get people singing along loudly, in tune, right in your ear. So you're much more likely to be able to follow the thread and sing along with them. And this was a completely accidental finding that we made. We made this on a lark, and we played it at an opening, and people just loved the fact that they could push a button and change the perspective from the best seat in the house to the middle of the chorus. And that proved very useful, and it is a possibility for the future.
This reminds me of the ideas of sound field, which, again, is an interesting medium, but sort of promised that kind of feeling, but it was never as intense as what you're describing.
Well, what we have is a platform of loudspeaker layouts and how to scale them from small rooms to large rooms. And it is amenable to all kinds of microphone techniques, including, among others, sound field. And we use those techniques. We go from multi-channel, complete 48-track original studio overdubbed style recording, where we embed you in the center of the music with Herbie Hancock's Butterfly, to Shakespeare, Merry Wives of Windsor, Theater in the Round, except Inside Out, where the audience sits in the middle and the play, especially at night in the end of the play, takes place all around you. And that's a very simple recording with 12 microphones, 10 microphones rather, for 10 channels. And it works very well to image sound all around you. And we've done a lot of work with conventional orchestral presentation with the orchestra in front of you and the hall all around you. So it is a standardized playback platform, and it is deliberately non-standardized on the record side so that all kinds of techniques can be used.
One of the things that really interested me in your talk that you gave at the School of Sound was that you talked about working with Herbie Hancock on surround music. Is this new kind of surround music? Is this a new take on quadraphonic music?
Well, there are basically two approaches. One is best seat in the house, and the other is in the band. And what's interesting is that when customers are interviewed by a Gallup survey in the United States, something like 70-some percent of them say they prefer the best seat in the house, with perhaps the ambience of the crowd and the reverberation around them. Yet the producers want to push the envelope and go the other direction with a lot of embedded sound. Well, that frightens a certain amount of the public to be embedded in that way. On the other hand, Herbie, having done this work with us some years ago now, has been subsequently touring here in Europe with a surround setup, and he has two mixers now. One does the principal mix of balance, and the other one does the surround mix of where things go in his annual summertime concerts. So I think these are threads. There are many reasons to do this. Coming out of, believe it or not, command and control interfaces in World War II, it was found that if you move the buzzer, the klaxon, and the bell to separate walls, you can hear them more clearly than if you cluster them together. It shows that just spreading out sound around you helps to delineate lines of content like music. For instance, this cut we did called Butterfly was made at great expense for an album, and it was conceived in surround, but the record company said, no, we don't know what that is. Deliver it in two channels, please. They did, and as Herbie will tell you, it was a big flop in the marketplace. It's because by taking many threads simultaneously and shoving them through two channels, it just obscures one another. Whereas if you spread them out over multiple channels, you can follow musical lines much more clearly. So it does show that for musicians, the greater the density of loudspeaker channels, the wider the sweet spot is. It's not the opposite. Some people think that, oh, if you add 10 channels, you narrowed the sweet spot. No, you actually increase the sweet spot with the number of channels. And you are able to delineate more music more clearly.
I wonder why it's not taking off, because now that people have sort of in their homes surround cinema setups, they could so easily listen to this music, to these DVDs, CDs, at home in this way. I'm sure it's about to change. I know that you said today that in fact the sales of this sort of music is slumped, it's not taken off at all, which really surprises me. Why is this? Is it merely because the technology is not there and perhaps the music isn't being made?
Well, I think the technology is there. What the record producers always say is that the sound systems are terrible. But I don't think the good ones are so terrible. There are really two ways these are bought in the United States, and perhaps here. One is as a fully installed system, a home theater. Because they're so complicated to run the wires and everything, people rely on outside sources to do this, and there's a whole trade show involved in it called Cedia that's grown from 100 people in a few years ago when I attended, maybe 1992 or so, until I think last year was 17,000 people are installing home theaters. And the other way to buy it is as home theater in a box. And while these systems are perhaps compromised, they're at least relatively easy to install, and they do the spatial component. You know, we've heard forever, when mono became stereo, the audiophile said, back to mono. Everybody's spending half as much on the loudspeakers, and therefore it couldn't be any good. But stereo sold in large numbers to millions of people because it worked. And likewise, we're sort of in that era of surround sound. Whereas, well, if you're going to spend five halves or two-fifths on each speaker, whichever, that maybe there's some compromise involved, yet the best systems are very good ones. I think one of the problems with surround music is the understanding of what to do with the medium. I think another problem is it's not a very hot medium in Marshall McLuhan terms. People expect a picture today, and when there's no picture of the concert, just sitting down and listening to music, which was a big deal in the 1950s, is really kind of disappeared from the scene. It's more treated as a commodity. You know, when I gave a meeting of the Boston Audio Society in the 70s, they'd have 600 people in a meeting. And today they're lucky to get together 60. Those people who were hobbyists kind of went off into computers and into other things. And it has become much more of a commodity, perhaps, than it was at one time. But and MP3s and so forth, the general downgrading of things to incidental to people's existence instead of primary to it, probably means that hurt the introduction of surround music. What's coming out now is called dual disc, a double-sided thing with CD on one side, so you can play it as it is, and with DVD on the other side, so that it can be with an accompanying picture. And you notice that's a very deliberate term, because when we wrote ITU Recommendation 775, it's called multi-channel sound with and without accompanying picture. Because there were so many times where the video boys got there first and said, sound for picture. No, this is you can have this without the picture, thank you very much.
So a whole area is being lost, isn't it? They're really missing out on an opportunity, because I'm sure if they were to market it right, it would be very, very popular. Perhaps that's probably part of the problem.
Well, I think it's a lifestyle matter of people sitting down, having the time to simply listen to music as opposed to playing it in the background of their lives, you know, running the vacuum cleaner. I'm not sure it's completely a marketing thing. I think it's driven by the fact the medium is a kind of cool medium. You know, you have to imagine. It's like radio plays. Not a very big market today. Wonderful medium, but very little of work in that way in the United States. People kind of respond to the hotter media of accompanying a picture.
Now, I was also thinking about your own ideas on film, being here at this film event. It's interesting to hear what people think as their, you know, favourite film soundtrack or sound design. Do you particularly see that there's a film that sort of withholds perfect surround sound? Who would you say has achieved this?
Well, the interesting thing is it's the second film ever made. It's Apocalypse Now. One of the reasons it's so wonderful, besides working out by Walter Murch, is they spent over a year in post-production. So they had a lot of time to try things out, and it was very experimental. And they'd go back and forth between the theater and the dubstage. Today, it's all, you know, it's no longer experimental. It's considered something that you have to get out in a certain number of days and so forth. And it's much more commercially driven. So it's perhaps a little less good, maybe, than early experimental views done with a lot of thought behind it.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end, no safety. And all the children are
What's most interesting to me is that when we made the video transfers for Laserdisc of Apocalypse Now a few years ago now, it was the initial part of the THX digital mastering program, Walter came in and gave a talk, and he told us why the surround sound is so wonderful in Apocalypse Now. They were dead scared because they'd never produced anything even in stereo. They were all monaural work up until that time, doing monaural work. And so when they did this, it was just a complete new thing. And they spent a great deal of time thinking about it and doing it. So that 5.1 channel soundtrack is the reason why the world went from 4 to 5.1 channels. Because in an ITU meeting, I played it at Skywalker Ranch and showed that the 4-channel system, which was already on the air with Muse in Japan, was simply not adequate. Because 5 channels was the minimum necessary to achieve the effects desired.
So really, as ever, it's really the mavericks, the people that are pushing things forward, the people working alone, perhaps as academics and trying things out. I know that you also are a lecturer, aren't you, in California. Does that give you the time to push your limits and never be satisfied?
Absolutely. If I had to be a commercial company doing 10.2 channel sound, I know that I would lose because my stockholders would ask, where's the profit? But in fact, it has to go in this direction. Whether I win or somebody else wins, it's immaterial. The directional push will be in favor of more channels as time goes by. There's just no doubt in my mind. And by working in a university where we have the facilities, they've built us wonderful new rooms for this and so forth, because we are pushing the limits of the envelope.
Well, I'm really looking forward to actually hearing some 10.2. Obviously, with radio, we've only got FM, so we've only got 2 speakers, unfortunately. Again, have you ever done any experiments that involve using radio to transmit surround sound?
Well, not radio, but Internet 2, the next generation of Internet, which runs at 1.5 gigabits per second. And we have done live transmissions, real-time transmissions, from servers in Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles for a conference of Internet 2, where we portrayed 45 megabit per second high definition pictures and around 30 megabit per second 10.2 channel sound, all in real time. You know, and my interesting for technical people, the network people come to me and they say, well, we're only losing 1 bit in a million. And I say, well, I can hear 1 bit in a million. And they say, oh, you're crazy. You can't hear 1 bit in a million. And they play it, and I hear the clicks, and I tell them where all the dropouts are. And then they go back, and they discover how to improve TCP/IP, the network protocols, so that with selective retransmission, they can deliver all the bits. So, you know, Internet 2 could be used for shipping around data on how to make nuclear bombs, or it could be used for a channel or two of very high definition picture and multi-channel sound. And of course, when anybody asks me, well, what would you do with the rest of the bandwidth? is put down more channels. It's easy. Can you imagine 100 channels of 45 megabit per second picture and 30 megabit per second sound? I have the killer app for internet too.
So if people want to know more about this, is there a website they should look at?
Well, I don't know that there's one, but say tmhlabs.com. That's my website. Should steer you somewhere.
Certainly. It sounds, and I know you've been conducting sort of live experiments, haven't you, across the state, or across the world probably, because obviously it's the internet.
We don't really have the bandwidth to other countries yet. We are talking about doing that, but it is very difficult. One thing we've been doing is a collaborative music performance across internet too. And there are issues here in particular, of lag because of the time it takes to make packets and transmit them. And even, ultimately, the speed of light from coast to coast gets into the act.
You've written several books on surround sound. Perhaps you'd like to give them a sort of little plug here, so people who may, if this may be a whole new area, may be interested to find out more.
Well, for people just starting, probably my second book called 5.1 Surround Sound Up and Running is the place to start. It does give you a little history, but it also gives you some production technique and some of each of the areas, recording, editing, and mixing. I have a new book coming out this summer called Sound for Digital Video that doesn't, frankly, cover surround sound in any great detail, but it is looking toward the new media. And eventually, of course, there'll be new editions of Sound for Film and Television, my principal book, and the 5.1 Surround Sound book.
Could you also tell me what you've enjoyed at the School of Sound this year and, you know, what's been a standout moment for you?
Well, I think Pierre's presentation, the opening day of sound as in the radio medium, sort of set the stage. While it isn't sound for picture, it nevertheless, you know, told a story, produced empathy in the audience, did all of the things that the drama is supposed to do, including the catharsis, even in the short segments, 2 minutes long, that he played.
He certainly brought a lot of emotion to the occasion, didn't he?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me this afternoon, and I can't wait to go and hear some 10.2.
Thank you very much.
That was surround sound inventor Tomlinson Holman talking to me at this year's School of Sound. I hope you've enjoyed the programme. Tune in on the 4th of July at 7 to hear interviews from the School of Sound with film director of cult classic Radio On, Chris Petit, Ren Clyce, sound designer of Fight Club, Seven and Being John Malkovich, and Oscar-winning composer Gabriel Yared. If you'd like more information about the School of Sound, have a look online at www.schoolofsound.co.uk, or you can contact me, Mags, M-A-G-Z, at resonancefm.com. My weekly show, You Are Here, can be heard on Mondays at 8:30 p.m. Have a look at www.youarehere.co.uk. That's youarehere.co.uk. Tonight we have a live session from Chevron.